most people holding the 60/40 portfolio have a huge bet on peace and globalization. It's been the truth in the past, but it is not necessarily the norm in the future. And so a critical thing is to help to create a diversified portfolio that helps protect against less globalization and more global conflict is not an exercise in projecting that it might happen. It's recognizing and having the humility to understand that you don't know what's going to happen. And so it's much more important to be prepared for a lot of different outcomes than for any one particular outcome.
Imagine spending an hour with the world's greatest traders. Imagine learning from their experiences, their successes, and their failures. Imagine no more. Welcome to Top Traders Unplugged, the place where you can learn from the best hedge fund managers in the world so you can take your manager, due diligence, or investment career to the next level. Before we begin today's conversation, remember to keep two things in mind. All the discussion we'll have about investment performance is about the past, and past performance does not guarantee or even infer anything about future performance. Also understand that there's a significant risk of financial loss with all investment strategies, and you need to request and understand the specific risks from the investment manager about their product before you make investment decisions. Here's your host, veteran hedge fund manager, Niels Kastrup Larsen.
Bob, welcome to the podcast, and thank you so much for joining Jim and I today for what I'm sure will be an insightful and fun conversation as part of our Global Macro series. Now, since this is your first time on the show, I do want to ask a little bit about your background, but since I'm sure many of our listeners already know of you, I would like to ask them in a slightly different fashion. So you spent 13 years at Bridgewater, and you write on your LinkedIn profile that you were Ray Dalio's right-hand man for a decade. Now, this must, of course, have given you unrestricted access to Ray, and I wonder if you can talk a little bit about what you learned from him and what you've taken with you in setting up unlimited funds, and perhaps also what you did not want to bring with you.
Great questions, and thanks so much for having me on the podcast. I've really enjoyed this listening to this podcast over time, so it's fun to make my small contribution to it. You know, my time at Bridgewater, for me, it was a great place to develop that sort of core fundamental understanding of how the macroeconomy works, how markets work, and then take that understanding and translate it into systematic investment strategies. And I think if you sort of ask the question, what were some of the biggest things that I learned from working so closely with Ray for a long time? I think the core idea that what happens in the macroeconomy and financial markets is not random. It's driven by a set of fundamental cause-effect linkages and rule and the sort of things that you can intuitively understand, you can write down, you can measure, you can assess on an ongoing basis often in quantitative ways, not exclusively, but often in quantitative ways, and that you actually get a lot of advantage from basically taking your sort of collected wisdom of how the world works and how markets work and writing that down and systematizing it so that what you do instead in your day-to-day is not focus on rebuilding your understanding every day, but in the way, you know, traditional discretionary traders essentially do, but instead to focus on the questions that you don't know and you don't understand and incrementally ask those questions in order to sort of compound your learning and understanding over time. And so, you know, it's not the ideas of fundamental systematic macro are not really, it's not like build a GPS, drive it off the cliff. It's like get leverage in a common sense way, which is don't have to rebuild your understanding every day.
I think that's interesting. And before we pivot into sort of the global macro topics that we're going to talk about, I was wondering, as I was listening to you, I would say that that description may not necessarily be unique to Bridgewater. I mean, a lot of people have kind of quantified stuff. I mean, I come from the trend following world where everything is rules based, but not everyone is Bridgewater, right? Not everyone became so successful. So is there anything, and I'm just curious really for personal interest, I mean, what do you think made it so successful? Was there some kind of, I don't know, What was the secret sauce, if you know what I mean, in becoming so successful? Not necessarily the secret sauce of the strategy, but how it all turned out.
Yeah, I think the idea of systematizing macroeconomic understanding is more novel. Was more novel 20 years ago than it seems today. You're totally right. Like over the course of the last 20 years, essentially, if you walk down the street in New York and go to one shop after another, essentially everyone has done some amount of, you know, macroeconomic and markets systemization. And the reason why that is because essentially you have to do that to keep up with all the other folks. But, you know, 20 years ago, the concept of, you know, macro systemization, trading macro markets in that way, you know, macro was the world of the big bets to, you know, big discretionary bets. And so the idea of saying, look, we're not going to take big discretionary bets, but we're going to have, you know, hundreds of small bets that are driven by systematic understanding. In a lot of ways, I'd say similar to the insights that the trend followers, you know, the trend followers, I mean, really had those insights like decades before that in terms of a way of managing money. It was a different type of approach in terms of just like what was being measured and how the views were created and things like that. But it was in a similar vein and similarly novel. I think one of the challenges with it is that, you know, in a lot of ways, the rest of the world, you know, much of the world caught up, mostly, you know, much of the most sophisticated asset managers in the world caught up to that understanding. And so in order to continue to, you know, continue to be outperforming the rest of the world, you have to keep evolving and innovating. And I think there's room to do that, lots of different ways that can be done. But that's the core challenge is, you know, that moat of novel insight and way to manage money decays over time, the way it decays for all asset managers. And so innovation then becomes key, and a commitment to continue to innovate over time becomes key in order to stay in the lead.
Very interesting, fascinating stuff. Thanks you for sharing a few of the insights. Now, since I now understand that you and Jim on a regular basis speak about these things, before you get into your jive, I will throw the first question. And that's just really maybe as a starting point. Perhaps you could share kind of your big picture assessment. I know we've got lots of data coming in at the moment, even today, but kind of big picture wise, how do you see the global macro framework right now?
Well, I think the biggest dynamic that's going on that I think is confusing a lot of folks is that we're experiencing an income-driven expansion. And that sort of expansion, an income-driven expansion rather than a credit-led expansion, is very different than the business cycles that really have existed over the course of the last 30 or 40 years. And so what's happening is that interest rates are rising, and that is on the margin slowing credit creation, as you'd expect, and increasing debt service. But it's not anywhere near a big enough drag to overcome the consistency of income growth that is translating to a consistency of spending growth that is actually quite durable and sustainable. And so if you were to sort of very simply describe what's going on in the macroeconomy today, wages and salary growth of households in the U.S. is growing between 5 and 6% in aggregate. Nominal spending growth is growing between 5 and 6% in aggregate. The savings rate is by and large flat, you know, wiggles month to month, but by and large flat. And that is a dynamic that can persist for an extremely long period of time. And at its core, you know, because unlike credit creation, credit booms, you get unsustainable debt buildups that can't continue. You know, income dominance, let's call it, is the sort of thing that can continue. You know, if I spend $100 and hand it to you, and you earn that $100 and then spend the $100 and hand it to me, we can go back and forth. There's no reason why that can't persist for an extended period of time. There's no debt. There's no liability. There's no excess. Nothing is built up that's problematic in that process. And so I think when you look at folks kind of fumble around and are confused, you know, if you look at how the Fed describes it, they're confused. I mean, read that Kashkari essay recently, and he basically is like, I am confused. Interest rates seem high, but nothing seems to be going wrong in the economy. I am confused. And it's because, you know, he has a debt-driven mindset on what's going on with the economy rather than income-driven mindset. And similarly, I think people are trying to find, you know, is it interest income, which is relatively de minimis in the grand scheme of an economy that's booming? They're searching for the fiscal without sort of recognizing that actually we've had a fiscal contraction over the course of the last 3 or 4 years at the time when GDP is booming. And so people are fumbling around for sort of the things that they know versus going back and looking at this cycle through that income dominance lens, which, to be honest, is a lot much more similar to sort of cycles of the 50s and 60s. So if you go back and study those cycles, this actually looks very familiar. It's just none of us have lived through a cycle that looks like this in our professional life.
Yeah, I mean, you and I, Bob, have been fortunate to be out in front of the higher for longer thesis, right? You and I have talked about this at length now. I think it's going on a couple of years since we've been talking about it, but I know we've both been on top of that. We have broadly similar views. I agree that it is income driven to a great extent. It is because we're driving a demand side economy versus a supply side driven economy, right? You send capital, you lower interest rates and you do QE, you send money to the top and you send it to capital and supply. But if we start doing fiscal spending, right, that goes to people on the bottom. And that ultimately is a demand side economy. I'd love to hear how long. I think this is the most important aspect, as you highlight, that you know, what's happening to the cost of money and interest rates. And I'd love to hear your thoughts on how long is higher for longer and how high is high. You know, let's get into the details. Where do you see this going and why? Hold your feet to the fire so we can measure this down the road as well.
Yeah, well, the current state that we're in with interest rates, let's say 4.5%, and income growth the way that it's growing, and basically interest rates have been here, you know, roughly for the last 2 years, give or take, you know, 18 months, 2 years. So we've had elevated interest rates for an extended period of time, and nonetheless, we've had 7 quarters of at or above potential sort of total domestic demand, you know, getting around the sort of wiggles of the way that GDP is accounted for. And so what I'd say is in many ways right now in this current environment, we're in a bit of a stasis, a sustainable stasis environment where you can continue to have, you know, income growth the way that it is. Interest rates aren't high enough to create enough of a drag in the economy to slow down spending, to slow down asset prices. And this can continue for an extended period of time. The main issue with this current environment is not growth. Growth is fine. The main issue is inflation's too high and that the amount of nominal spending that's occurring in the economy is just too high relative to the amount of productive capacity growth in the economy. And so while we've made a lot of progress on inflation relative to the sort of supply chain driven inflation that happened, you know, a couple of years ago, We're stabilizing. We've seen over the course of the last 6 months, we're stabilizing at a rate of inflation that's too high, inconsistent with the Fed's mandate. And so when I think about this problem and how long can it persist, it's less about a time frame, a calendar time frame, and more about a set of linkages. What needs to happen in order to create a slowdown and in order to curb inflation? And what needs to happen there is you have to have, if we have an income-driven expansion, then what has to happen is spending needs to slow. Well, what will cause spending to slow? What has to happen is asset prices have to shift. So households have to become more fearful. You know, right now, if you're a household, you're like, my 401k is booming, my house is booming, you know, my stock account is booming. Like, why should I save more? Right. So what has to happen is assets have to start to decline in value in order to shift away from spending out of existing income. And then the question is, how do you get asset prices to fall? Well, it basically has to happen one of two ways. Either you get an exogenous, unexpected shock that, you know, none of us are planning for, or you have to have a sufficient tightening of financial conditions to start to drag on asset prices. So that means either the Fed's got to do it or essentially the bond market has to do it on its own. And so that set of linkages, it's less of a temporal thing and more an order of the linkages, which is first yields rise, then asset prices fall, then spending slows, then earnings slow, then you get layoffs and decreases in wage income. And then that creates the negative spiral that eventually brings inflation down to target. But so far, you know, the Fed certainly doesn't seem to be doing the work. And the long end of the bond market seems to be constrained a bit by the Fed not doing the work, as well as the fact that there's easings in global jurisdictions. And so that's creating, you know, that's creating pressure, dragging the U.S. bond market, the U.S. bond yield down relative to the strength of the domestic economy.
But what you're speaking to are really the cyclical effects, right? And this is what the Fed has, is in charge of, essentially, is controlling money supply and trying to manage the business cycle. And agreed at some point, if they push hard enough, they will make it tough enough for assets, and assets will decline, as you mentioned, and the economy will slow, right? This will happen. This is what's happened for 40 years. But this is, as you mentioned yourself, how every Fed governor, how most people have thought about inflation and how it works. But the reality, as you mentioned, and we both know, is there's something going on under the hood that's not just about the business cycle, right? There are structural effects that are tied to fiscal spending, deglobalization, right? All the things that we're seeing that are driving structural inflation. And that's why this is different this time around, in my view. So, I mean, let's say that kicks in the next year, right? After the election, interest rates have been held long enough. There's a lag and things really start to, or they're forced to raise because inflation picks up and eventually things roll over, assets come down, et cetera. Okay, inflation CPI comes down for a bit, maybe gets down to 2%. But then what, right? Then what? Then we pivot away from the 5.5% interest rates or whatever it is at that point. And then there's a ton of pent-up demand for real estate, and there's a ton of pent-up, for money. And when that happens, we're going to have likely these same structural effects continue, in my view. Do you agree with that? And if so, you know, is inflation here to stay? Or do you think this is, you know, we're going to get into, you know, once we finally prick inflation here and it comes down to 2%, 1%, we're going to solve this and get back to where we were?
Well, I think a lot of the sort of core structural dynamics that were persistent over the course of the sort of 40 years before COVID that drove disinflationary pressures are mostly gone. And you touch on a few of them. You know, we basically went from a period of not particularly well globally integrated to very globally integrated, and China entering the WTO being a big part of that. We went from a period where, we had a billion people working on the farm, and now they have moved into the factory, and that's massively increased, you know, across Asia, and that's massively increased their productive capacity. We had a period, I think probably doesn't get talked about enough, of an unusual period of peace globally. If you looked at, for instance, the amount of the loss of life in global conflicts over the course of the previous 40 years before the Russia-Ukraine conflict, it was basically at 1,000-year lows. And so that's the sort of thing that you wouldn't you wouldn't necessarily expect to persist. And I think that there's certainly indications that it is not going to persist on a forward-looking basis. And war is inflationary structurally. Peace is disinflationary. War is inflationary, both because of the destruction of material involved with it, but also because it creates a pullback of globalization, trade, all the big disinflationary pressures that exist. I think more structurally, a lot of the deep-seated disinflationary forces that existed in the U.S. economy that really created that risk of deflation in the post-GFC period have mostly been resolved, in the sense of, you know, household balance sheets are in fantastic shape. You know, 15 years ago, they were in terrible shape. Business balance sheets are in great, generally in great shape, particularly big business balance sheets are in great shape. You know, they were in real trouble 15 years ago. And so that confluence of things, deglobalization, increased conflict, the resolution essentially of the deleveraging dynamic and the debt overhang in the post-GFC period, all of that points to higher inflation ahead rather than lower inflation ahead relative to what we experienced pre-COVID. I think the main question, is The Fed basically has one tool to resolve that issue, which is to constrain domestic nominal demand. So if we're in a period where domestic, you know, where inflationary pressures are persistent, then the question is, do they respond to that by reducing domestic nominal demand in order to contain inflation, or do they choose not to respond to that and essentially allow inflation to run hot for an extended period of time? That's a big question that has yet to be resolved. And I think, you know, each day we sort of incrementally learn a bit of information about it. But I think that's the real outstanding question, because if we're in an environment where not only do we have those higher inflationary pressures, but the Fed is accommodating to those higher inflationary pressures, that's going to be a very different long-term macroeconomic environment than we've seen in the last couple of decades.
I couldn't agree more with that last comment. You know, that's the big question still. The Fed has yet to come out and say they're okay with that. I don't know that they ever will, just because, whether they believe that or not, just because if they do, then they lose control of the long end of the curve, and that makes inflation worse, right? So I think a lot of when we hear, you know, we're now on transitory 3.0, I think is what I call it. Like, you know, they keep saying, you know, inflation is transitory. But the reason they do that is not because I actually think they think it's transitory. It's because they want to try and convince the market that it could be. And so they keep the longer end of the curve down. And at some point, I think the market doesn't keep falling for that trick, right? You know, and that's what we saw in the 70s. The market kind of was like, okay, you know, we believe you, you can control inflation, until they couldn't. And then it just took off, right? So, you know, again, remains to be seen, but I agree with your points. And I think we broadly agree that there's a structural element to this inflation, and that is trying to be controlled cyclically, and that they can control it short-term cyclically. We can look at CPI coming down, but they have a stagflationary issue at the end of the day. They're dealing with inflation you know, the economy slowing at the same time. And at some point they'll have to choose. Whereas for 40 years, they basically didn't, because they were in a structurally deflationary period. You know, that's a big deal. So what works in that environment? What are we, I know you're big on commodities and gold. Talk to me a little bit about what you see asset allocation, kind of how it should look in the years ahead.
I think the outstanding question, for what it's worth, whether or not they actually are going to give up or are giving up on the inflation mandate at 2%. I think there's a lot of folks who think that, oh, you sort of casually say, oh, well, they're political, so they're just trying to simulate the economy, or, oh, they're just giving up on it. I'm not sure that that's right with this composition, this Fed composition. When I look at how they're behaving, which is, to be clear, they've said lots of times they're going to cut and have done nothing for the last, you know, 9 months. And likely, you know, we'll see if they do nothing, if inflation remains where it is today. And you look at their commentary about trying to understand what's going on, it looks more like they don't understand what's going on and are too concerned about a credit style cycle rather than, that would hit growth. They look more concerned about that than they do about being sort of okay with inflation being where it is. And you could sort of get that sense where they sort of consistently are kind of like surprised that inflation is rising relative to what they expected, rather than sort of saying, hey, look, it's fine. You know, it'll come down eventually. Don't worry about any of this stuff. It's totally fine. So that's, I think people are attributing political motives to a lack of understanding and I can understand why. It looks, the behaviors look very similar, but I think that's what's going on. And so I'm not yet given up on this Fed, having given up on the 2% inflation mandate yet. And to be clear, that could change. We could have a different administration. They could put different pressures on the Fed. You know, the Fed's independence is not a guarantee. It certainly hasn't been a guarantee. Part of the story that has existed back in that 70s period was actually very close coordination between the Fed and Fed Treasury and the president, putting pressure on keeping monetary policy persistently easy relative to financial conditions. So it's certainly not a given over the course of the next 10 years. What I would say is, look, big picture, the odds that the two asset portfolio, the 60-40 portfolio of stocks and bonds, both of which are highly benefit from a period of secularly disinflationary strong growth are likely to be the best portfolio on a forward-looking basis, where we're likely to have weaker growth and higher inflation. Like, that's not going to happen. And so most investors are not going to be particularly well prepared for an environment that's different than the last 40 years and what they learned. And so what that means is looking for diversification to protect yourself against the possibility of higher for longer inflation, more persistent inflation, and driving a bigger share of what's driving assets on an ongoing basis. And so what that means is basically it's about gold and commodities. You know, those assets are assets that no one seems to hold in their portfolio, but are critically important diversifiers if we're moving into a period of higher inflation.
Can I throw in a question to both of you just on the kind of this topic and the previous topic in particular? You talk about these structural changes and what's going on and people not being able to really explain this. I'm sure Jim and I talked about this before and maybe you as well, Bob, but how do you see the demographic factor play into all of this? Because my suspicion is that that might have a very pivotal role in one, not being that easy to explain because we haven't really seen the demographic shifts before, at least not for a long time. And actually, this will take a long time to play out, even though a lot of people have talked about it coming. You know, I can't remember when Harry Dent started talking about demographics, but it's a long time and nothing happened. Maybe it's happening now, but at such a slow pace that we don't really know how to measure it and model it and so on and so forth. I'd love to hear your thoughts about that, both of you.
Well, I think the demographic story, you know, at a big picture level, we're pulling workers out of the economy, productive capacity essentially out of the economy, and those workers are continuing to spend to some extent, right? You know, their production value is zero once they retire, and their spending on houses and goods and services is certainly not zero. You know, if you were just to look at that on the surface, you'd say, hey, look, that looks like an inflationary, on the margin, inflationary pressure, primarily through the fact that demand would likely continue to keep labor markets relatively tight, given that demand continues and labor supply is more moderated. I think people get confused because they look at Japan and they say Japan had terrible demographics for an extended period of time, and therefore it must be a deflationary force in the economy. And I think they confuse the fact that you have to think about the demographic environment in the context of the monetary policy environment. So the reason why Japan had a big deflationary environment is because their monetary policy was way too tight for 20 years, 30 years even. So there's a question about whether it's too tight even today on a secular basis. And so the effective outcome will be a function of the inflationary dynamic that comes from labor losses relative to the monetary policy and the acceptable amount of nominal demand that the Fed implements. And so what if the Fed is basically says, hey, look, we're going to have the same amount of nominal demand. I think this is basically what's happening right now. Fed's like, we want good nominal demand, 5-6% nominal demand growth. But the labor force, you know, goes from expanding at 1 or 1.5% a year, the way it was before, you know, back in the 90s, to zero to negative. Well, you know, very simply, you can't have those two things work out. You can't have the same rate of nominal demand growth and, you know, significantly less people unless you have, you know, incredible productivity boom, which is possible. You know, certainly that's a possible option, or higher prices. Like that's just the way it works out. Or you have to get labor supply, you know, from somewhere else, which, you know, we've gotten a little bit of that and it's kind of offset excess retirements. And so hasn't been as acute as it would have been otherwise. But like that's how those figures have to work out. So it's really that interplay between the demographics and the Fed that will determine whether it's inflationary or deflationary ahead.
Jim, you studied the 50s, 60s, and 70s. You've written about it, and you refer to it often as the last time we had real inflation. And I was wondering, in doing that research, obviously the world and the Western world, we lost a lot of young people after World War II. And so there was a lack of young people coming into the 60s and the 70s. Do you think that played a big role in why it played out the way it did back then? Or
I think the part that we don't talk about that interrelates to demographics is it's not just about the number of people, it's about the mentality of the number of people, right? So it's scale and kind of magnitude. And we all have a collective memory of what's happened the last during our collective childhoods and our periods that we're around. And as a generation, we are different than other generations as a result of that. This seems very soft and qualitative, but it's actually critically important and is a primary driver to cycles. I've talked about this before, but you know, we for 40 years have sent money to capital, and that's created a difference in inequality. This is a measurable thing. We know this. We know Gini coefficients have gone from 0.34 to 0.45 in the U.S. They're starting to go the other way after last several couple years, but a long way to go. What that's done is that's made people who are labor on the bottom unhappy. But that's important. It's important. It's not just stratification. You can turn that stratification on its side, right? And the bottom in labor is youth. You know, when you come out of college, you're labor. And when you retire, you're capital. And so the younger generation, millennials, have a collective memory of underperforming. They're at 40% of the wealth creation and household formation of baby boomers at this point in their generation. So yes, they're the new bubble, smaller than the baby boomers. But that collective bubble now is growing to political dominance. And they've had this collective memory. And so they want different things. They want labor rights. They want protectionism. They don't want the same thing that the last generation had. So yes, importantly, to Bob's point, older generation is both retiring and dying off. And the younger generation is coming too. And that difference in labor supply makes a big difference. But even bigger than that, is the fact that we're closing our borders to China, right? Is that we're, as Bob referenced, you know, that we're the protectionism that comes with that populism is massive. And again, you know, Bob spoke to war, fiscal spending, the deglobalization and protectionism, all those things are connected. They're all tied to, you know, we had lower interest rates for a while. We got inequality and now we don't want to, you know, we want to protect and send money to people. And that populism is what's important. So I think demographics is critical. But not just in terms of numbers, but you know the numbers matter as well. So gold, I agree with you, Bob, by the way. Like the commodities, gold was the best performer during that 60s and 70s period until 82. But it was very volatile, right? And different parts of, and commodities broadly performed very differently. Yes, broadly commodities did well, but do you have a certain way you like to own gold or you know, different types of commodities in particular that you look at that you think are going to be particularly great performers and how would you trade them?
Yeah, when I think about building a strategic portfolio, I think you don't want to get too cute about exactly what you're investing in. Like you want to build a diversified portfolio that is going to be able to handle a wide range of different circumstances, and in particular, I'd say something that you don't have to think about much, like a good savings portfolio. You don't think about, right? You just, maybe you rebalance once a year or something like that. And then like, that's it. And then you wait another year before you think about it again. And so in that context, like I always lean more towards diversification rather than trying to be specific. You know, I think gold, there's a lot of different ways that people talk about holding gold. And I think some of the challenges, you know, people say, well, what if I hold the miners or I hold, you know, physical and stuff like that? Like, you know, for 99% of people, like buying gold ETFs is by and large fine and gets you the exposure that you need. And you don't have to stress too much about it. And you can do it in your portfolio. When you think about broader commodity price, broader commodity assets, lots of easy ways to be able to invest in those. Again, I would be more inclined to diversification. Like how many people who are out here, you know, were pounding the table saying that, you know, cocoa was going to go through the roof in the ag space over the course of this year. Like nobody bet that. And that partially that speaks to the fact that, you know, you don't necessarily know from a strategic perspective which particular commodities are going to do well and not, and which are squeezed and which are going to meet, you know, significant production increases and things like that. So you're much better off buying a diversified, balanced portfolio. Not one overweight oil, but, you know, there's lots of lots of different types of options that are out there. If you want to buy sort of a CRB type index, a diversified index of commodities, and that way, you know, you're prepared for a lot of different outcomes in terms of what in particular gets squeezed as part of the overall dynamic, the overall sort of higher nominal growth dynamic, and protecting yourself from those outcomes.
Yeah, no, I agree, especially given some of the volatility that happens in these cycles. The interesting thing about that word diversification is, you know, that means a lot of different things to different people, right? You know, some people think they're diversified by being, you know, and diversified equities in the S&P 500, right? And I think we're trying to bring up an interesting point that you need diversification and strategy. You need to diversify away from beta and equities and bonds even. I know, you know, what you're trying to do with your ETFs are you know, and again, you worked in the hedge fund space, is also to bring kind of other diversified alternatives. You know, in our wealth advisory business, we have an allocation of about 30-35% into alternatives. And when I say alternatives, I'm not even talking about private equity, which I think is correlated to, you know, beta. I'm talking about really hedge funds, non-correlated returns, event-driven, you know, arbitrage strategies. We can go on and on about them. What do you think when you say diversification broadly? Let's move away from commodities broadly. How do you look at diversification, and how do you think you know, people should be allocated broadly across their portfolio?
Yeah, I when people were struggling basically with the 60-40 back in 2022, I wrote up I had actually a client come to me and basically say, if I'm trying to build, you know, a long-term savings portfolio, what do I build? Like, what should I go do? And I said, I was working through, and I basically came up with this thing I call a simple game plan, which basically, you know, the set it and forget it portfolio. And what that starts with is, you know, you want to start with beta. And there's a good reason why beta, when I mean beta, I mean holding risky assets, not holding cash, but holding risky assets, because you'd expect assets to go up relative to cash over time. And that's very valuable to have in your portfolio. That's a very reliable return. You just want to hold that in a very diversified way. And there's lots of different ways to think about that. But even something as simple as just, you know, holding equal risk weight between stocks, bonds, gold, and diversified commodities gets you 90% of the way there in terms of structuring a good beta portfolio. You know, the problem right now is most people say you hold a 60-40 stock bond mix. That's 95% driven by the stock market, given the relative volatilities of the two different types of assets. And so build that diversified beta portfolio. And then what I'd say is tilt it towards inflation protection assets. And the reason why that is because the real risk for most investors is not that assets go down, it's that inflation goes up relative to assets, right? So what you're trying to create is you're trying to protect purchasing power or real wealth over the long term and compound real wealth over the long term. And so you naturally want to be tilted towards inflationary assets. There are assets that do well in inflation, like tips, gold, commodities, relative to assets that don't do well during inflation, like bonds. Instead, what the world is tilted towards is towards bonds and not inflationary assets, right? So they're doing the exact wrong thing to create a long-term real wealth portfolio. And then I'd add on top of that, the ability to add diversified alpha to your portfolio. I think there's lots of different ways to do that. You know, some of the easiest ways is just like add some trend following to your portfolio and you're going to be in pretty good shape. And you know, the amount, something like 10 or 15% of your portfolio allocated to trend following has very high bang for the buck, works pretty well. There's lots of different easy ways to do that for most investors. The advent of all these great ETFs that are out there, great way to do it, very efficient. You can put it in your portfolio. And that really, that combination, and the reason why you want to add that is because sometimes assets don't do well relative to cash. And sometimes, you know, certain assets do better than other assets. And if you're running your diversified portfolio, like, look, we all sit around and do this all day, right? We're following, you know, what's going on in the markets, you know, We're trying to deliver alpha on an ongoing basis. That is challenging in and of itself. And we spend our whole, you know, all of our days focused on trying to do this. as a retail investor or a saving, you know, a traditional saver, like you cannot compete with what's going on with, you know, what's going on with the most sophisticated investors in the world. So you're much better off, much, much better. And I mean that by retail investors. I mean that by financial advisors. Like financial advisors aren't spending enough time to be able to reliably create edge. And so what that means is find ways to systematically get edge into your portfolio, get that agility into your portfolio. So you focus on what you need to do, whether it's your day-to-day life or whether it's building great relationships with your clients, and get away from trying to do it yourself, because you're never going to do it as well as the people who are spending all day, every day focused on creating that alpha return stream. And so that's the overall portfolio, which is basically diversified beta tilted towards inflation protection with about 20% allocated to diversified alpha strategies in one form or another.
I agree. I think the only thing I would throw out there is there are long periods where, again, 68 to 82, last time we saw bottom left to top right interest rates, I'm not just picking that number out of the air, we had a 765% decline in real terms of equities. Like 65%, 14 years you invested, you lost two-thirds of your money. This idea that stocks for the long run, buy and hold, doesn't work for long periods of time. And that's not only does it work, is a quick way to the poorhouse. And I think there's a broad assumption because of the last 40 years and because interest rates have gone top left to bottom right. Again, it is that simple that equities should be the core part of your portfolio. By the way, this isn't the case across the whole world. You know, this is a really U.S.-centric, Western kind of phenomena, right? And the question is it right for the long run? I don't know that it's necessarily right. Now, businesses should make money over the long run. And you, if you find businesses that make money over the long run that outpace inflation, you will do well. I agree with that concept, right? Obviously. But I think you really have to be thoughtful. I think, you know, you need to invest in the economy and not in the market. I think that kind of Warren Buffett way of investing where you look at DCF will work.
Right.
But if you're just indexing and doing it 60-40, I think that's a problem. And we need real diversification. And I agree with a lot of what you're saying. So love to hear a bit about kind of how you think the average person should get, you mentioned a little bit, but access to alternatives. I know you're trying to make it cheaper for people to do that and easier for retail investors to get access to alternatives. Again, I said, I think, you know, you should have a 30 to 40% exposure to alternatives. Other than your own products, you know, how does somebody do this? And then maybe speak a little bit about kind of what that approach should look like.
I think the main thing with alternatives that you have to be laser focused on whenever you're thinking about them is the trade-off between the alpha that you're getting and the fees that you're paying. And I should say also for a taxable investor, the taxes you're paying. And so I think one of the challenges of the world of alternatives is that, you know, most of the alternatives that are out there and a lot of what is being promoted, you know, in the financial advisory space are traditional, you know, LP positions in 2-in-20 style funds. And so if you just think about that and you think about what does that mean for the end investor, just take a traditional LP structure, alpha fund in some way, shape or form that's targeting 10% returns. Well, you take that 10% return, gross returns, and you charge 2-in-20 fees. Now we're down to 6. Then what happens is you have to, of course, pay the government. And if you're in those funds, you're probably at the top marginal tax rate. So maybe we'll call that 50% to oversimplify it. And now you're at 3. And then, of course, you have to pay your financial advisor. That comes after you pay your taxes, another 100 basis points. You know, that puts you down to 1. And you probably, in a lot of these circumstances, have to pay some sort of platform fee, maybe 50 basis points, maybe 100 basis points, right? And now... Now you're down to like single, you know, you're down to like 1-2% returns. Everyone in the world has gotten paid, right? The tax man's been paid. The asset manager's been paid. Your financial advisor's been paid. The platform's been paid and you get nothing, essentially nothing. You're much better off buying having a bank deposit than having all of those risks. And so I think that's the core challenge in the alternative space. It's not the alpha. Managers are great at generating alpha, fantastic at generating alpha. The problem is they're also fantastic at keeping it for themselves. And Uncle Sam is not helping along the way as well in terms of how these things get structured. And so when you're thinking about alternatives, what you want to be focused on is how many fees am I paying and what's the tax structure? And if you turn your attention away from, you know, if you turn your attention to those things, what you find is that the significant number of particularly ETF style alternatives are really effective in that way because they are almost always much lower fee in structure, and they're almost always much more tax efficient than what you typically experience with an LP position. And so you put that together, and let's say instead of, you know, that 10 becoming one, we have a situation where you're, you know, charged only 100 basis points and a circumstance where you're paying, you know, mostly capital gains rather than marginal income tax, and where you're not paying platform fees, and where you can do it yourself instead of paying, you know, a financial advisor 1%. Well, that then puts a lot of alpha back in your pocket. And that's really what investors care about, is what's the alpha that they get net of fees, net of taxes, net of financial advisory fees, net of all that stuff. The biggest problem in the 2-in-20 space is the fees. So that's what you got to be laser focused on.
I mean, you probably, if you listen to the podcast, you probably know that we've had some heated conversations on the trend following ETF kind of replicator side of things. And, you know, I have mixed feelings about sort of this, because when I hear you talk about this, it almost sounds like, yeah, okay, here's a way you can save 9%. It doesn't quite show up in the numbers as replicator funds, you know, producing 9% better returns, or 4%, or as we have in the trend following space, where initially at least it was claimed that, oh yeah, 3-4% will do better than the industry, no problem, and it turned out it wasn't so easy. And I don't, and by the way, the industry, at least in my experience, it's not really 2-in-20 anymore, but it's what it's known for. But that's not really what we're able to achieve. But you came from the side where clearly it was difficult to invest, and I'm sure Bridgewater was not the cheapest fund. I don't know what the fees are. But I'm interested in what made you want to suddenly kind of almost go the opposite way and say, listen, don't invest with people like Bridgewater anymore. Come to me and we'll replicate and we'll give it to you much cheaper at a much lower tax. What drove that inside of you? I'm curious about that process.
Yeah, I you know, during my time at Bridgewater and actually running a venture fund, $125 million venture fund afterwards, I got a chance to basically to work with some of the biggest, most sophisticated asset managers in the world. And I think the thing that I increasingly realized was, first, they allocate a ton of money, a ton of their portfolio to alternatives, like something like 50% of their portfolio. You know, Jem says, you know, hey, look, 30% goes to alternatives. Well, if you're a big institutional allocator, 50% goes to alternatives, right? So I think that's a pretty interesting portfolio decision, which is not what the, you know, the vast majority of investors don't allocate anything close to that in terms of alternatives. And the second thing, which is very interesting in terms of what they do, is if you're some of the most sophisticated asset managers, what you do is you invest in dozens of funds across all sorts of different strategies. And in that process, because you have a lot of capital, you beat down the fees. And so you're right. If you're, you know, a top sovereign wealth fund, you're not paying 2-in-20. You're certainly not paying 2-in-20 and a platform fee the way a retail investor would, or a lower AUM sort of qualified investor, something like that, or accredited investor. What you're paying is something that's a lot closer to 100 basis points on average than it is to 400 or 500 basis points on average. And so what are these big institutional investors doing? They're essentially creating low-cost index funds of alpha strategies. And so that really, in a lot of ways, was what sort of the genesis of the idea was to say, hey, look, if we can create, you know, the biggest institutional investors in the world create low-cost index funds of alternative investments. Okay, how can we do that thing, but do it for, you know, the everyday investor so that they can start to build portfolios that are much closer to what institutional asset allocators are able to do rather than, you know, the options that they have available. And so that really was the inspiration. Like, you know, personally, I found that, and I continue to find that to be much more interesting and compelling. Like, you know, anyone has proprietary views. You can have, you know, you can hang your shingle, charge 2 and 20, you know, run a nice little business. But that doesn't meaningfully influence and evolve the way in which the everyday investor is able to invest their money and build wealth over time. And so that's what's really compelling to me. And I love the fact that at least in the ETF space, look, you can invest $20 or you can invest $20 million. The access is the same. And that is a huge deal when we think about how can we get everyone to be able to build better long-term savings portfolios, not just the very wealthy or the institutional.
And I agree with that. I think that has been one of the things where I definitely think there is a big advantage in the replicator funds that it has given access to people who would not otherwise do. But I will say, I don't want this to be made, so I want to go one more global stuff before we wrap up. But I will say, my concern is, though, that those, for the most part, who would actually benefit from this are also the ones who don't quite understand the difference and the risks. Because I hear the argument about, oh yeah, but we are removing manager risk because one manager can be great 1 year and next and then, yeah, yeah. But you're introducing another manager risk, and that's the replicator. And that algo, if that goes rogue, I mean, then, you know, what happens then? So it's a very interesting debate, and I'm sure we'll have you back, Bob, to talk about more about replication and what we're going to do today. But I want to ask one question to both of you, because it brings, it's kind of sort of trying to summarize a little bit this idea about the environment we're in right now, but also the environment that we're heading towards, and it may already have started. From my, and again, I'm not an expert in Bridgewater or Ray Dalio, but I read some of his stuff, and he seemed to be very well connected with China. So I have a feeling that maybe, Bob, you also know more about China than I do. And in 2021, Xi Jinping gave a speech where he said, the single most important word to describe the world today is chaos. And that this would be in China's favor. And Jim and I are actually going to speak with someone who's written a book about China in a month or so and some of the risks that he sees. But it almost sounded like that they were the instigator of chaos, and maybe in conjunction with his friend Putin. And if that is the case, which, if you look back the last 3 years, it certainly would suggest that the world is moving into a much more chaotic state than what we've seen before, then this could last for a very, very long time. And I kind of just wanted to circle back a little bit, maybe to hear whether you have any thoughts on this, but also to the point that you made earlier, that the majority of investors are probably invested in the wrong way, because that is not the environment that the 60 portfolio was created for.
Right. I think the key thing when I hear that sort of perspective or speculation is to have humility about whether or not that is true. I think what causes macro investors to get out over their skis is where they start to project the fact that they have understanding of how macroeconomic systems work to how political systems work. Two very different things. A skill set in one does not connect to a skill set in the other. And so as an investor, it's very important to understand what your edge is and where that is and where that ends. And for me in particular, let's call it sort of geopolitical perspectives is not an area where you should listen to what I have to say, because I don't have an edge in projecting what is likely to happen. What I can say is, from a macroeconomic perspective, various geopolitical outcomes have various macroeconomic consequences, let's say, and that those consequences, the question is, do you want to be prepared for a wide variety of those different consequences, given the uncertainty Or do you want to be concentrated in a particular set of outcomes? And that's where I'd say, I'd emphasize, like, most people holding the 60-40 portfolio have a huge bet on peace and globalization. It's been the truth in the past, but it is not necessarily the norm in the future. And so a critical thing is to help to create a diversified portfolio that helps protect against less globalization and more global conflict is not an exercise in projecting that it might happen. It's recognizing and having the humility to understand that you don't know what's going to happen. And so it's much more important to be prepared for a lot of different outcomes than for any one particular outcome.
I'll say one thing, one response to that is the world did 60-40 and didn't diversify away from that outcome for 40 years, and it worked out really well. And so I do think getting it right broadly is very important. Now, to your point, I think if we just diversify for all outcomes, you may end up with 50% of your portfolio in 60-40 and losing two-thirds on your portfolio. So I hear you, diversification matters, but at some point you also have to kind of back up and look at the big picture and see where things are more likely to go and bet, you know, more heavily in that way. I do agree 100% with you on that alternatives are a great way to do that. And again, very non-correlated. There are embedded advantages in rising interest rate environments to particularly hedge funds because of derivatives and the ability to both get your higher yield and use that collateral for other outcomes and to have a more efficiency of capital. So I think similar to a lot of the institutions you talked about, I think that's key. And even though you may not get all those benefits from reducing, from simplifying it and making it available to all, I do think there are benefits to that still to a broad range.
We're coming up to the hour, but I want to give both of you a chance to bring up any topics that you think we should also touch upon before we wrap up. Anything we left out? There's so many things we could have talked to you about, Bob, but we tried to cover as many of them as possible, but may not have covered. Anything else that you find in particular sort of interesting on your radar right now that we haven't brought up, Bob?
Well, we haven't really talked about what's going on in the global exchange rate markets, which I think from a macro investor's perspective is always top of mind. And I think when you look at what's happening globally, there is more, we basically have gone through the last 5 years have been a pretty correlated period, and particularly across developed economies, but really globally, it's been pretty correlated, probably China being the main outlier. And I think increasingly what we're seeing in the fundamental conditions is divergences that are functions of policy divergences. And so in particular, I think people sort of talk about U.S. exceptionalism as if it's manna from above rather than simply a function of different policy choices in terms of how the economy is running and different structures of the economy. But this idea that, the U.S. economy continues to have higher levels of inflation, stronger nominal growth rates, which will likely lead to higher for longer monetary policy, whereas other economies, Europe in particular, but also Japan to some extent, are likely to have, easier monetary policy for an extended period of time, given their both structural and cyclical dynamics, is the sort of thing that will likely put pressure on the dollar to continue to be strong relative to the rest of the world. And I think cuts really counter to there's sort of this general theme that's out there in the market right now that we're going to have like a U.S. sovereign debt crisis or whatever at the time when the dollar basically hasn't been this strong in decades. And I think that divergence in policy and macroeconomic, driven by macroeconomic conditions diverging from each other, will continue to sort of emphasize the dollar relative to other developed exchange rates, which will surprise, I suspect, a lot of people over the course of the next couple of years.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. Actually, historically, in these types of periods, what I do primarily is trade volatility and look at volatility markets. The volatility during that period in FX and gold, which I, by the way, are I think more similar than gold is to oil, even, right? Are the assets that are the most volatile during those periods and represent the most opportunities too. So it couldn't be more historically that definitely is in line. People think that broadly all commodities are volatile during this period because they think about OPEC in the 70s. But the reality is oil was actually not very volatile. It had a very clear upward trend and didn't have a ton of volatility the 70s was underpinned by OPEC. So kind of that was like a Fed put essentially on oil, which really reduced volatility. So there are a lot of other assets that have had volatility priced into them, which are kind of false. Whereas FX and again, gold are areas where I think calls in particular in gold and other types of hedges and FX are wonderful opportunities in the long run.
I want to wrap up this conversation, and unfortunately, Bob, I have to leave the last question with Jim, because our audience were once again treated a couple of weeks ago from a very important call by Jim over the last OPEX and this in particular period around sort of the beginning of May that we called out on the podcast or Jim did. So I can't help just asking you, Jim, because I know the audience will be very interested. Is this playing out the way you see it? And any color you can give to our audience?
The reality is these flows day to day. We've been talking about macro. These are monthly, quarterly, annual. The big macro picture is much more annual, right? But in the short term, it's all about flows. It's all about the short-term moves. As long as the Fed comes in and underpins, doesn't start shaking things up and is supportive, as Bob has said, right? They've been broadly choosing in the context of a bigger picture between inflation and growth to underpin growth. Then the machine is at work, and that means puts decay every day. Hedgers have to buy those back. Companies buy back their stock, and the wheels keep turning. So we have gained the support we need in what would otherwise be a potentially risky period going into June. And I think it's pretty smooth sailing. This is an election year. Bob and I didn't get to talk about that this time, but an election year matters, particularly during a populist period. And this populist period means more spending. We're seeing it in ways that you wouldn't expect, but fiscal policy is alive and well. There's talk about Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac releasing second mortgages out to people. That'd be $7 trillion in liquidity, right? Something that most people are looking at. The Federal Trade Commission has a sweeping final rule to ban non-competes. If that gets passed, like that is really good for labor. And that's really inflationary, right? Now, whether that's good for earnings and whatnot, another story. But in the meantime, the fiscal spending and the support is here. We're seeing that in lots of ways. So I wouldn't get in the way of this in an election year.
Good stuff. Bob, this has been a tremendous conversation. Thoroughly enjoyed it. Thank you so much for doing this today. And by the way, make sure you follow and subscribe to Bob's work. As you can tell from today's conversation, we're living in a true global macro-driven world, and it is perhaps more important than ever before to stay well-informed. From Jim and me, thanks so much for listening. We look forward to being back with you as we continue our global macro series. And in the meantime, take care of yourself and take care of each other.
Thanks for listening to Top Traders Unplugged. If you feel you learned something of value from today's episode, the best way to stay updated is to go on over to iTunes and subscribe to the show so that you'll be sure to get all the new episodes as they're released. We have some amazing guests lined up for you, and to ensure our show continues to grow, please leave us an honest rating and review in iTunes. It only takes a minute, and it's the best way to show us you love the podcast. We'll see you next time on Top Traders Unplugged.